My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Diane Hammond. Diane, welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Thank you.
The title of your latest book is Seeing Stars. I'll read a few things about you, and then we can get to talking about this book, okay?
Great, absolutely.
Seeing Stars is published by Harper, and it's a lovely trade paperback. It's a good-looking book.
Thank you.
Yeah. You were born in New York State, lived in born in Queens, moved to Upper Nyack, which is deep suburbs, then back to Washington, then to Washington, D.C., which we share that, actually. You became an associate editor for various publications, a public relations director for Mount Vernon College, and then you began to write short stories and attending classes at the Glen Echo Writer Center, which used to be an amusement park, mm-hmm. and isn't very amusing anymore, is it?
No, it isn't.
And then you joined a number of ad hoc writing groups. Did you write much ad hoc while you were there?
No, okay.
Well, there's not much call for the ad hoc anymore. But you moved out to Newport, Oregon. Mm-hmm. Newport, that's Newport News, Virginia. Mm-hmm. Newport, Oregon. Mm-hmm. You were public relations manager for the mm-hmm. Oregon Coast Aquarium.
That's correct.
Did you do any, like, interviews with the starfish or anything?
No, I didn't. But we did interviews aplenty with a killer whale named Keiko.
Oh, that's right. You did the Keiko thing. It says that right here. The killer whale and the star of the movie Free Willy. You acted as Keiko's spokesperson mm-hmm. for the aquarium and then for the Free Willy mm-hmm. Keiko Foundation. Okay. And then after all that was over, you moved to Bend.
Correct.
Yeah. And so this is your fourth book because you have Going to Bend was one, Homesick Creek, and Hannah's Dream.
That's right.
Okay.
And now this one.
Well, I haven't read your other books. Excuse me for that. But this is a book about Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And you lived in L.A. for a while.
We did live in L.A. for 2 years while my daughter was a professional actor.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is a direct result of her experiences there, though she isn't in the book and neither am I or my husband. But it definitely took advantage of what we saw and how it all worked and how kids end up becoming or not becoming successful actors.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I read this book, I was thinking, is there anything that's not false or exploitative about the film business in Los Angeles?
Oh, you know, I think there still is something to be said for talent. I think that if you can dig deep enough, you do find good people and you do find incredibly talented people. And sometimes they get exactly what they deserve, which is good things.
I was going to say.
Yeah. The bad people don't generally get what they deserve. But the problem is one of numbers, for one thing. There are so many people chasing that dream, kids as well as grown-ups, that clearly, not everybody's going to make it. In fact, very few people make it. And that's where you begin to see the troublesome and ugly stuff is among the ranks of people who really have very little chance of ever going anywhere, but either they don't see it that way or their parents don't see it that way.
Hmm.
So among children, there certainly are many parents who are much more dedicated to living that dream than the kids are.
So the setup is that Ruth and her daughter Bethany have mm-hmm. gone to Los Angeles from Seattle, where poor Hugh is stuck back being a dentist in Seattle. He's the dad.
Yeah.
And they go off to Los Angeles so that Bethany, who is a very talented actor in a little small world of high school mm-hmm. drama and local mm-hmm. theater, can become a star.
Right.
And they meet a whole bunch of other people, some of whom are very nice and some of whom are not so nice.
Not at all. Yeah. Exactly.
Another thing I was thinking of when I was reading this is that Nathaniel West, mm-hmm. F. Scott Fitzgerald, these are writers who went to Hollywood and wrote scathing books mm-hmm. about Hollywood. Mm-hmm. In those days, in the 20s and 30s, Hollywood was a place where great writers went to squander their talent
yeah.
and become alcoholics. Dorothy Parker,
mm-hmm.
oh, she was probably drunk before she ever got there, but
it didn't do her any good,
though.
William
Faulkner wrote screenplays,
mm-hmm.
Including The Big Sleep, by the way. How does Hollywood manage to chew up all this talent and to still produce dreck?
Well, there's a good question I can't answer. Why isn't there greater quality coming out of all these people? You'd think there would be the talent to.
I suppose that's a nicer way to ask, yes.
Yeah. But, you know, the material is sort of the last of it. If you're an actor, you don't care what you're in. I mean, short of porn. I don't think that people aspire
That's
to porn.
That's a whole other business.
That is a whole other business.
It runs in parallel to the straight business.
Yes, and we lived on that street.
San Fernando Valley?
Yes. Yeah. Magnolia Boulevard, lots of porn studios. Mm. But except for that, you know, you'll take whatever you can get. My daughter was on a sitcom that for the 3 years it ran on the Fox network, was voted every year the worst sitcom of all of them.
Which
that
one
year.
Was it?
It was called The War at Home.
The War at
the
Home?
The War at Home.
I never heard of it.
Very few people have heard of it. It was a primetime sitcom, but just not well respected. And yet, my daughter got a guest star role on it, which is a pretty big deal, and it didn't. And it was prime time. Ooh, so we, you know, we knew the show wasn't the greatest. There's nothing harmful or inappropriate about it, but you don't turn that kind of thing down because it can lead to something bigger and better. And so you extrapolate that out over years, and you know, you've been spending time doing chicken commercials and touting McDonald's and having these little tiny roles on Nickelodeon or whatever else it might be. But you're just crawling up that wall, trying to get to a good place where you shine. And of course, most people never get to that good place.
Mm-hmm. We all know the classic myths about getting discovered sitting at Schwab's
right.
counter, or the fact that we saw Jodie Foster's tush in all those what Coppertone was that mm-hmm. what it was that she advertised for years before she ever acted yep. a lick. Does that stuff still happen? Did it ever happen?
There are people who are discovered. There are very few people, though, who are discovered. I know on one of the sitcoms that Carrie was on, it's a Nickelodeon sitcom called Ned's Declassified School Survival Guide. A lot of the tweens watch it. And the lead, one of the two leads, came from Ohio, hadn't done almost anything before, but she was a natural and did a really good job of that role. But it's really the minority. For the most part, you just have to get chewed up and spit out and keep coming back for more.
It requires a certain amount of ability to take a punch. Is
huge,
that a,
huge yeah. ability. And in fact, in Seeing Stars, one of the Ruth Rabinowitz, the newcomer, says, why are the casting directors so mean? These are children. And the more jaded woman next to her said, that's your first mistake. These aren't children. They're job applicants. And that's how they're treated. Is mm-hmm. Everybody's fighting to land the same job. So there isn't a whole lot of coddling the kids. There isn't a lot of let's protect them from rejection. And no, if you're going to do this, you're going to, whether you're 2 years old or 8 or 16, you're just not treated as a kid. And either you have the temperament to survive that, or you don't.
And we have to understand that if the lightning strikes and you are chosen for a sitcom or a theatrical film,
mm-hmm.
Not a student film,
right,
you know,
right.
or an indie film.
See,
but
so he knows the right. all of the terminology.
Right. It's you might you know you can put in you can buy the house in the valley with mm-hmm. with the pool and mm-hmm. that's right because the money is astounding.
Well, and that's the other thing that makes it so crazy when children are earning $100,000 a week, it makes their role within the family much different because they're usually bankrolling the family and not the other way around. And so parents parent these kids in a much more deferential way, want to be part of this money line essentially as long as possible. And so there are managerial fees that parents legally can take. And the more your kid's making money, the more the family's on the rise. So that complicates things as well.
So Bethany, mm-hmm. everybody calls her Bethy, and Ruth head down to L.A., mm-hmm. and they run into Mimi Roberts, who is a talent manager.
Correct.
She's not really Fagin, is she? I mean, she really cares for the kids mm-hmm. at some level.
On some level.
Yes, including one quite a lot that really gets under her skin.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, these are cash cows for her. Mm-hmm. She sees them, as you say, just as income property.
Mm-hmm. They are. And the services that she offers all have a price tag. And she, as real talent managers sometimes do, has taken in children whose families have left them in her care and gone back to Ohio or Seattle or wherever the rest of the family is. And so these children really are kind of orphans. They are in a studio that's open from, say, 9 in the morning till midnight, and they may be there that entire day doing schoolwork, whatever. Well, there's a 7-Eleven downstairs, there's a Papa John's pizza next door, and the kids basically forage. They have their own money, and they buy their meals and take care of themselves and travel in little packs, and it's amazing. And some of these children are 9, 10, 11 years old. These aren't teenagers. And yet their parents are so determined that they have the ability to become stars. We met some people whose children had absolutely no talent, none. And the manager tried to send them home, basically persuade the family, your child has no chance here and wants to go home. No, they wouldn't have it. The child was going to become a star. The parents were absolutely sure they had the ability, so they were staying. And what do? You then become, you know, as a manager, you're now the caretaker for these children who are kind of running wild, and it's very difficult.
We hear about classic stage mothers, stage parents, really, because mm-hmm. it's not always just the mothers, trying to live out vicariously through their children. Mm-hmm. And apparently that has never gone away.
No. We saw it every day. In fact, one of the things that a lot of the mothers that I knew would say to ourselves is, please don't make me a stage mom. Let me be doing this for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. And one of the difficulties down there is some people have talent, but not drive. Some people have drive, but not talent. And it's the very rare person who has both. And a lot of what we were seeing was that the parent was delusional, basically, about their child's ability or their child's drive to become famous and viable in this very toxic environment. And so that was another thing we always thought about was, please, if we're pushing hard, let it be no harder than our daughter is capable of going. And in our case, we had told her, this is for you, not for us. And if you decide this is no longer something you want to do, all you have to do is say so.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Diane Hammond, H-A-M-M-O-N-D. The title of the novel is Seeing Stars, and it's published by Harper. It's interesting you to say that, because I'm thinking there are any number of actors in film and even on television, where you say, you know, I haven't seen this person in a mm-hmm. long time. They make one film about every 3 years, right. Sissy Spacek or somebody like that. They have all this talent, but they either don't have the constitution to deal with Hollywood on a day-to-day basis, or they just approach the time in their lives when they pick and choose what mm-hmm. they want to do. And then the other end, you have a guy like Chuck Barris, who has enough drive for a trucking company and has zero talent.
Right.
And is there a discernible talent mm-hmm. in any case? Mm-hmm. And that's the spectrum. And everything falls somewhere between those two things.
Yes, it does. And I would never want to be the actor. Being the parent of an actor was a whole different ballgame. But I don't know how these kids do it. Audition after audition after audition and rejection after rejection after rejection. And then if a child is fairly successful, the final callback, you've been through multiple auditions for a role, the final callback is very often your child and three or four others that you know very well, because you're always the ones left. Only one of you is going to get the job. And it's never one of the children that we knew was always in this position, and it was never him. He would be right there, one of two, one of three, and he was never the one chosen. And how do you get up in the morning, day after day after day, knowing it's probably not going to be you today either? You've achieved a certain level of rejection, much as writers do. You get rejected by the best periodicals and feel proud. But, you know, to just keep getting punched like that every day is very hard. And a lot of the kids drop out when they're 16. It's too much, or it's not what they wanted, or they just feel bad about themselves, or they get smart and decide to go to college and pursue something else.
Yeah, well, then you have your Natalie Portmans and mm-hmm. you're again Jodie Foster, mm-hmm. who managed to cut out a life for themselves beyond the movies.
Yeah, so, and yeah. those names are conjured every day as proof that there's a way to do it right, where mm-hmm. you don't sacrifice education.
Yeah.
But think about it. Those are two women. I might come up with a third name if I thought for a bit.
Even a couple of guys, maybe.
Yeah, but out of the whole country, the whole world of people who thinks that they can make a career at this, they're superb actors, but they also were lucky to find the right directors and to find the right managers and people who were willing to support that kind of lifestyle so they could go to college. And they only did filming in the summer, vacations, whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's extraordinarily unlikely.
Yeah, I think when Hitchcock said that actors were cattle, this is a little bit what he was talking about.
Yeah, unfortunately so.
I got to tell you, don't take this as a negative criticism because it's not. When I started reading this book, I said, oh, boy, this is going to be, you know, a really crunchy social satire of the whole Hollywood system. But you love your characters mm-hmm. too much. You really do. Yeah, you're nodding vigorously here. You can't be cruel to them, ultimately. And ultimately, you want all of them to in some way prevail.
Well, yes, I completely agree with you. And there were no villains in this book.
Well,
not even
Chet is a pretty bad guy.
Yeah, I guess. And Mimi Roberts was... kind of.
Oh, no.
She started out being bad, and then
complex.
I redeemed her.
Quote unquote complex, yes.
But you know, that was part of the tragedy, I think, in the real world. We met a lot of people who were doing just the wrong things, but it was always out of goodness of heart. I really don't know that we met anybody that was so hard boiled that they were essentially abusing their children. They wanted more than their children did, but it's not the same as being abusive. Mm-hmm. But I usually kind of fall for my characters. There's a certain point in writing about them when you decide, I really like this guy, and I'm not going to let too much bad happen to him.
Yeah.
And this
you fell in love with
the
characters,
same.
Yeah? So that's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let me talk about a couple of these characters.
Sure.
Allison Addison. I don't know if that's a good name for an actor, but she's been through the mill. She's one of Mimi's orphans. Mm-hmm. She lives at the house. Her mother really doesn't care if she ever shows up at home again.
Mm-hmm.
She's married to an oil man who just bankrolls everything that just to keep the kid away. She's what we used to call a remittance man. In effect, she's getting paid to stay away from her parents, her mother and her mother's boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
She's completely self-possessed. She's at, what, 16?
Mm-hmm.
And she has the demeanor and attitude of a 25-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
She not that deep below the surface. She's a scared kid,
mm-hmm.
but she compensates for that amazingly.
Mm-hmm.
There are two other kids, Reba and Hillary, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And Reba's a bit chunky.
Mm-hmm.
And she spends all of her time being wagging her finger, telling Reba not to eat that other Snickers or whatever is it, you know. So she kind of den mothers the people because Mimi's never around to do that.
Correct.
Where did you meet anybody like Allison?
Yeah,
tell
definitely.
Us about this.
So, well, she was a composite of a trio of girls that we knew at the studio where Carrie's manager worked. And they were three orphans in that case, and one of them was very much like Allison, and one of them was very much like Reba, and one like Hillary. And these kids are feral, not in a creepy criminal sense, but they really were raising each other because Mimi was their manager, not their parent, as she made clear to the families. And so these kids had pocket money, and they were bringing each other up. And Allison, as the oldest of them, was kind of leading the way and setting down standards and bossing the younger ones around and telling them what they should do or shouldn't do. She was definitely the leader of the pack. But there were kids just like that. I mean, that was not far-fetched. Each character in here was based on someone I came across. I didn't necessarily know them well, and the backstories are completely different. But in my mind, I started with somebody.
This is the disease of being a writer.
Yes,
you talk to somebody in 5 minutes, and you write a whole screenplay about their lives.
True.
Yes,
nobody is completely sacred. But and the things that happen to these kids are also very plausible. And so they live. I mean, these kids live for me every day. And we worry still about the real kids that we left down there and what happened to them. We kind of keep up with them over the internet.
It's important to add also that Allison is extremely talented.
Very talented. She is one of the two people in the book that really, really, really has enough to make it. The other one is Quinn.
Quinn, we'll talk about him right now. Well, yeah, let's do that. Quinn Riley, great mm-hmm. name, great actor's name. Unless it was originally like Jaime Berkowitz and he changed it, but I doubt
it. But it still would have been a better name. There you go.
Quinn Riley is, again, what, 16 years
mm-hmm.
old?
Mm-hmm.
a little bit gender confused, but not really. Also living feral-y. He's living with a couple of very strange people. Mm-hmm. What is it? Baby Sue and Jasper.
Baby Sue and Jasper.
Yeah. He's basically couch surfing at their house.
Yes.
And he doesn't have a lot of internal resources. He's not an intelligent person necessarily, although he's very insightful. He's always working out what's going on in his mind. And he runs into a hairdresser named Quattro. Tell us about this relationship.
Well, Quinn, as we meet him, has just been banished from the manager's house, from Mimi Roberts' house, and has only found one couple that will take him in. He's essentially just living on their living room floor, and he's lonely, and he's odd, and he's immature, but he's a brilliant actor. And in West Hollywood, which is largely gay, or a lot of it is gay, he walked the streets and poked his nose into a hair salon at one point, and Quattro saw him, and they began to talk, and Quinn got his hair cut, not that he needed it, but he really wanted to be in the presence of someone who was interested in him. And they do become very good friends. And to the point where Quinn, who is not gay, would like to be gay just because it would mean that he would be appropriate company for Quattro.
He's a pleaser. He wants to please this guy because nobody's nice to him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Quattro understands the conflict and they work through that. And he proves to be a big brother kind of figure in Quinn's life. And Quinn is the best of them in terms of his acting ability. So Quattro moves into the role of encourager and big brother.
Very
and
sweet
supporter.
Relationship. Mm-hmm. This is a charming and warm. It's in the middle of this, all this evil and exploitation and coldness and indifference. This is a very sweet relationship.
Yes. And it essentially saves Quinn. It gives him the strength. The casting director also takes interest in him. And it gives him the strength to continue acting. He really would have liked to go home to Seattle, but his family won't let him. He was difficult as a child, and they basically sold him to Mimi. And so this is the best he can do, but his resources are certainly not many.
Wait, talk about trafficking in humans.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's also V. Velman, who she's your Greek chorus. There's a little epigram at the beginning of each chapter, which V explains how things really are, and she's a friend of Ruth's.
Correct.
They call each other back and forth.
Correct.
You must have had a V. Velman in your life.
You know, I think V was kind of a composite of a number of people, all of whom had been there for a long time. V is a woman who has brought her kids up in L.A. They've always lived there, and so she jokes at one point that acting and auditioning is what kids in L.A. do instead of 4-H. She's the voice of reason. She's the one who calls the shots the way they really are and helps Ruth Rabinowitz, who's completely deer in the headlights, begins to teach Ruth the things that she needs to know. And they are quite caustic at times and quite cynical, but they're real. And you know, the world is not what Ruth thought it would be, and V is the voice of normalcy, or as normal as you can get in that part of California.
She bears witness to my feeling that no matter how cynical you become, you can never keep up. Yes. You name check a lot of actors and directors in this thing, but Gus Van Sant is a major presence and even does a cameo walk-on at the end of the book.
Yes.
Did you talk to Gus about this?
I did not. I was very grateful that the legal department at HarperCollins let me use him. Because he is a director who will use kids off the street, who will give the unknowns a crack at the lead. And because of his Oregon connection, too, that was probably one of the greatest self-pleasing things about the book. He is in the book casting a movie in which the lead, there are two leads, a male and a female, and either one, word on the street had it, might be a kid who'd never done much of anything before, which of course means that kids like Bethany and the Orphans and Quinn and Allison have a crack at a lead role, which otherwise never happens because of the money, if nothing else, invested in the leads. If you can't carry a movie, you're not going to be hired to do it. And unknowns are truly unknown entities. But so toward the late middle of the book and on, the kids are beginning to prepare themselves to audition with Gus Van Sant. And the opportunity is huge. And I did get on the internet and listen to a couple of interviews done with him so that I hope I got the cadence of his speech right. I might not have, but I tried.
You still haven't called this guy up and said, I'll send you a copy of my book. Please don't sue me. I mean,
call me a chicken. I don't think he would sue me. I think he'd be pleased, but
probably would.
I'm sure I'm too starstruck to do that.
I'm told, I don't know Gus Van Sant personally, but I'm told he's a good guy.
So is I.
In reading this book, it occurs to me that if your ambitions are small, mm-hmm. it's possible to do really well. For example, there's the cliche about Hollywood that all of the cab drivers have a screenplay in their glove compartment. there are people in Hollywood who have never had a screenplay produced who keep optioning them.
Yes.
Basically, you sell it for 3 years, and if they don't produce it, it's yours again,
right.
and then you can resell it.
Right.
So there are people living on 10 screenplays, living quite well, thank
right.
you, who've never had a movie produced.
Yeah.
And if your ambitions are small, you can do commercials mm-hmm. for the rest of your life.
Oh, you can make a mint doing commercials too, if
residuals.
It's a good campaign, exactly.
Every time they show that, they send you a check,
right? And but in the world of actors, those who are commercial actors are kind of secondary tier to those who have theatrical roles. So, but there's definitely the kids in the book, for instance, seem to land commercial roles fairly easily. And in fact, one of the kids, Laurel, just wants to get into a dramatic role, a theatrical role, just once. And she's amazingly successful commercially. Mm-hmm. So there is that kind of two-class system. But you can do much better as a commercial actor financially than playing bit parts, you know, to a year or whatever it might be with no residuals.
I didn't get into the Angie and Laurel mm-hmm. and Dillard relationship, which is another sweet family relationship. And, you know, Laurel is a pageant victim
yes.
who manages to have risen above that. You know, she's actually a pretty well-adjusted girl.
Mm-hmm.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm already in the middle of a book that happens back up in Oregon. I've left California again. And this one's about three middle-aged people, all of whom have been abandoned in some way. And they live in a coastal, it's essentially based on Toledo, Oregon, so 12 miles inland from the coast. Another fairly eccentric collection of characters. I love these characters dearly. They're a little bit older than the ones I've been writing about lately. And their challenges are not nearly as glamorous. They're just good people trying to make a good living under fairly difficult circumstances, which is much what my first two books were about as well.
That sounds like a metaphor for life to
uh-huh.
me. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in. I've been speaking with Diane Hammond. The title of her novel is Seeing Stars, published by Harper. Come back when your new book is ready.
I'd be delighted. Thank you for having me.